we left off last night, Winston is at work in his cubicle, and his assignment is to eliminate historical references to someone named Withers, and in the manner that the Ministry of Truth did that. That was Winston's job, to alter the past, which altered the present, which allowed you to control past, present, and future. Winston did not know why Withers had been disgraced. Perhaps it was for corruption or incompetence. Perhaps Big Brother was merely getting rid of a too popular subordinate. Perhaps Withers or someone close to him had been suspected of heretical tendencies. Or perhaps, what was likeliest of all, the thing had simply happened because purges and vaporizations were a necessary part of the mechanics of government. The only real clue lay in the words, "Refs unperson SM," which indicated that Withers was already dead. You could not invariably assume this to be the case when people were arrested. Sometimes they were released and allowed to remain at liberty for as much as a year or two before being executed. Very occasionally, some person whom you had believed dead long since would make a ghostly reappearance at some public trial where he would implicate hundreds of others by his testimony before vanishing, this time forever. Withers, however, was already an unperson. He did not exist. He had never existed. Winston decided that it would not be enough simply to reverse the tendency of Big Brother's speech. It was better to make it deal with something totally unconnected with its original subject. He might turn the speech into the usual denunciation of traitors and thought criminals, but that was a little too obvious. While to invent a victory at the front or some triumph of overproduction in the ninth three-year plan might complicate the records too much, what was needed was a piece of pure fantasy. Suddenly, there sprang into his mind, ready-made as it were, the image of a certain Comrade Ogilvy, who had recently died in battle in heroic circumstances. There were occasions when Big Brother devoted his order for the day to commemorating some humble rank-and-file party member whose life and death he held up as an example worthy to be followed. Today, he should commemorate Comrade Ogilvy. It was true that there was no such person as Comrade Ogilvy, but a few lines of print and a couple of fake photographs would soon bring him into existence. Winston thought for a moment, then pulled the speak right toward him and began dictating in Big Brother's familiar style, a style at once military and pedantic, and because of a trick of asking questions and then promptly answering them, "What lessons do we learn from these facts, comrades? The lesson, which is also one of the fundamental principles of INGSOC, that..." etc., etc. That style was easy to imitate. At the age of 3, Comrade Ogilvy had refused all toys except a drum, a submachine gun, and a model helicopter. At 6, a year early, by a special relaxation of the rules, he had joined the spies. At 9, he had been a troop leader. At 11, he had denounced his uncle to the thought police after overhearing a conversation which appeared to him to have criminal tendencies. At 17, he had been a district organizer of the Junior Anti-Sex League. At 19, he had designed a hand grenade which had been adopted by the Ministry of Peace and which, at its first trial, had killed 31 Eurasian prisoners in one burst. At 23, he had perished in action, pursued by enemy jet planes while flying over the Indian Ocean with important dispatches. He had weighted his body with his machine gun and leapt out of the helicopter into deep water, dispatches and all, an end, said Big Brother, which it was impossible to contemplate without feelings of envy. Big Brother added a few remarks on the purity and single-mindedness of Comrade Ogilvy's life. He was a total abstainer and a non-smoker, and no recreations except a daily hour in the gymnasium, and had taken a vow of celibacy, believing marriage and the care of a family to be incompatible with a 24-hour-a-day devotion to duty. He had no subject of conversation except the principles of INGSOC, and no aim in life except the defeat of the Eurasian enemy and the hunting down of spies, saboteurs, thought criminals, and traitors generally. Winston debated with himself whether to award Comrade Ogilvy the Order of Conspicuous Merit. In the end, he decided against it because of the unnecessary cross-referencing that it would entail. Once again, he glanced at his rival in the opposite cubicle. Something seemed to tell him with certainty that Tillotson was busy on the same job as himself. There was no way of knowing whose job would finally be adopted, but he felt a profound conviction that it would be his own. Comrade Ogilvy, unimagined an hour ago, was now a fact. It struck him as curious that you could create dead men but not living ones. Comrade Ogilvy, who had never existed in the present, now existed in the past. And when once the act of forgery was forgotten, he would exist just as authentically and upon the same evidence as Charlemagne or Julius Caesar. In the low-ceilinged canteen, deep underground, the lunch queue jerked slowly forward. The room was already very full and deafeningly noisy. From the grill at the counter, the steam of stew came pouring forth with a sour metallic smell which did not quite overcome the fumes of victory gin. On the far side of the room, there was a small bar, a mere hole in the wall, where gin could be bought at 10 cents the large nip. "Just the man I was looking for," said a voice at Winston's back. He turned round. It was his friend Sim, who worked in the research department. Perhaps friend was not exactly the right word. You did not have friends nowadays. You had comrades. But there were some comrades whose society was pleasanter than that of others. Sim was a philologist, a specialist in Newspeak. Indeed, he was one of the enormous team of experts now engaged in compiling the 11th edition of the Newspeak Dictionary. He was a tiny creature, smaller than Winston, with dark hair and large protuberant eyes, at once mournful and derisive, which seemed to search your face closely while he was speaking to you. "I wanted to talk to you whether you'd got any razor blades," he said. "Not one," said Winston with a sort of guilty haste. "I've tried all over the place. They don't exist any longer." Everyone kept asking you for razor blades. Actually, he had two unused ones which he was hoarding up. There had been a famine of them for months past. At any given moment, there was some necessary article which the party shops were unable to supply. Sometimes it was buttons. Sometimes it was darning wool. Sometimes it was shoelaces. At present, it was razor blades. You could only get hold of them, if at all, by scrounging more or less furtively on the free market. "I've been using the same blade for 6 weeks," he added untruthfully. The queue gave another jerk forward. As they halted, he turned and faced Sim again. Each of them took a greasy metal tray from a pile at the end of the counter. "Did you go and see the prisoners hang yesterday?" said Sim. "I was working," said Winston indifferently. "I shall see it on the flicks, I suppose." "A very inadequate substitute," said Sim. His mocking eyes roved over Winston's face. "I know you," the eyes seemed to say. "I see through you. I know very well why you didn't go to see those prisoners hanged." In an intellectual way, Sim was venomously orthodox. He would talk with a disagreeable, gloating satisfaction of helicopter raids on enemy villages and trials and confessions of thought criminals, the executions in the cellars of the Ministry of Love. Talking to him was largely a matter of getting him away from such subjects and entangling him, if possible, in the technicalities of Newspeak, on which he was authoritative and interesting. Winston turned his head a little aside to avoid the scrutiny of the large dark eyes. "It was a good hanging," said Sim reminiscently. "I think it spoils it when they tie their feet together. I like to see them kicking, and above all, at the end, the tongue sticking right out, and blue, a quite bright blue. That's the detail that appeals to me." "Next, please," yelled the white-aproned Pearl with the ladle. Winston and Sim pushed their trays beneath the grill. Onto each was dumped swiftly the regulation lunch, a metal pannikin of pinkish-gray stew, a hunk of bread, a cube of cheese, a mug of milkless victory coffee, and one saccharin tablet. "There's a table over there under that telescreen," said Sim. "Let's pick up a gin on the way." The gin was served out to them in handless china mugs. They threaded their way across the crowded room and unpacked their trays onto the metal-topped table, on one corner of which someone had left a pool of stew, a filthy liquid mess that had the appearance of vomit. Winston took up his mug of gin, paused for an instant to collect his nerve, and gulped the oily-tasting stuff down. When he had winked the tears out of his eyes, he suddenly discovered that he was hungry. He began swallowing spoonfuls of the stew, which, in among its general sloppiness, had cubes of spongy, pinkish stuff, which was probably a preparation of meat. Neither of them spoke again till they had emptied their pannikins. From the table at Winston's left, a little behind his back, someone was talking rapidly and continuously, a harsh gabble, almost like the quacking of a duck, which pierced the general uproar of the room. "How is the dictionary getting on?" said Winston, raising his voice to overcome the noise. "Slowly," said Sim. "I'm on the adjectives. It's fascinating." He had brightened up immediately at the mention of Newspeak. He pushed his pannikin aside, took up his chunk of bread in one delicate hand and his cheese in the other, and leaned across the table so as to be able to speak without shouting. "The 11th edition is the definitive edition," he said. "We're getting the language into its final shape, the shape it's going to have when nobody speaks anything else. When we've finished with it, people like you will have to learn it all over again. You think, I dare say, that our chief job is inventing new words, but not a bit of it. We're destroying words, scores of them, hundreds of them, every day. We're cutting the language down to the bone. The 11th edition won't contain a single word that will become obsolete before the year 2050. Falling on my head like a memory. Falling on my head like a new emotion.